Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Nimrod XV-250 is based at the Yorkshire Air Museum in Elvington, near York. She was dedicated by the Archbishop of York to stand as a permanent tribute to the 14 British servicemen killed in Afghanistan when Nimrod XV-230 crashed near Kandahar in September 2006. Her team of volunteers keep her in ground-running condition to remember all those aircrew and ground crew who served on the Kipper fleet. Ken Bannister joins me today to talk about the Maid of Moray, his RAF career with the Nimrod, and to help us better understand the Nimrod's capabilities as an anti-submarine warfare, search and rescue, and surveillance platform. Ken, welcome to Extended.
Oh, thanks very much. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you so much for joining us. You're here, of course, to help us understand a bit more about XV-250 and the Maid of Moray. But before we do that, can you talk me through your career so that we can put in context how your experience of the Nimrod is applicable here?
Yes, certainly. Well, I joined the Air Force at the age of 16 and a half. I'd wanted to be a pilot, but that didn't happen. And they persuaded me to go through apprentice training first and then possibly apply later. So I joined RAF Halton in January 1963, that very bad winter. That was awful. And I spent 3 years there. I trained as an airframe fitter. Originally, I wanted to be an engine fitter, sooty, but no. They only took about 12 of those. But they wanted 50 airframe fitters, so... Better than being an electrician, I suppose. But there you go. So, yeah, I trained as an airframe fitter. I left there in December 65 and went to RAF Scampton, January 66, and posted to a Blue Steel Missile Squadron as an airframe fitter, would you believe?
So I did. Wow.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Yeah. Well, you did. You had all the systems on it. And I did a Blue Steel airframe course, and I worked there for 3 to 4 years. And then I applied for an overseas posting. So they posted me off missiles onto Vulcan servicing. So I worked a little bit on the Vulcans. And then I was selected to be a transport aircraft servicing specialist, would you believe? So I did a Britannia airframe course and a Belfast airframe course and was posted out 1 year unaccompanied to Singapore.
When they were closing. Okay, interesting. Well, they were as a young man.
Yeah, they were closing Singapore down, and that's what happened. So I went there for a year, worked on VC-10s, Belfast, Britannias, Hercules, Comets, because Comets were still in service then. Worked on those. Yep. Then was posted back to Bryars Norton, where my first posting there was 12 months. I was a corporal then. I was 12 months on Britannia Roll Equipment Flight. Changing the roles on from passenger fit to cargo fit and all that sort of thing. I got promoted. Right. I got promoted to sergeant and posted to line servicing squadron. And then I did a VC-10 aircraft course. So I worked on the VC-10 and the Belfast. I became a line chief, responsible for seeing the airplanes off. And then I applied to become a ground engineer, which meant travelling with the aeroplane, servicing it, places where we didn't have any servicing personnel. So I did the first course I did was an electrics course, 6 weeks electrics course for a rigger, somebody who hits things with hammers and screwdriver and things. Electrics course? Dear, that was a bit of a nightmare, but it taught me a lot. And then I did an engine course, the Conway engine course, followed by the radio and radar and the instrument course. And I was then a fully qualified ground engineer. So for 4 years, I trucked around the world in a VC-10 servicing it. I've been all over the place. Been around the world 3 times. Once,
wow.
Twice in one direction and once in the other direction. Been right into the Arctic Circle, down South America, Australia, New Zealand. So, quite well travelled. It's what I joined
for. We love the VC-10. We love it.
Absolutely superb aeroplane. Silent, yeah. Swift, Silent, Superb is the book. So I did that. And during that time, there's a guy sitting on the flight deck who was an engineer. I thought, I'm an engineer. He's an engineer. So at one stage, I decided to apply for aircrew as a flight engineer. Not successful the first time because I said I was too old. Did it a different route, and eventually I was selected. And I went to RAF Finningley on number 90 Airman Aircrew Initial Training Course at Finningley. A year later, I passed out as a flight engineer, having done the training. Hard work, that was, but it was worth it.
And what aircraft were you doing the training on to become a flight engineer, Ken?
Well, we didn't do any aircrafts as such. We did 16 weeks in the classroom, and then the second phase was 8 weeks flying in the right-hand seat of the Domini, as it was then. That was a navigation trainer. And then phase three was advanced systems, where we did the Nimrod systems, Turk systems, and the Argosy. Okay. For the fourth part of it, the simulator at Benson was still in use, and that's how we qualified eventually on the simulator at Benson to get our flight engineer's brevet, the E-brevet.
So, okay.
Yeah, that was interesting, that was. After that, well, when we postings were coming up, there were eight of us on my course. They all said, we're going Hercules, going around the world. I said, you're not going to apply for Hercs then, Ken? I said, look, I've been around the world in style and comfort. I'm not, repeat, not going around the world in a truck. And that was my answer to that. So three of us posted to Nimrod, and the other five went to Hercs. So before we could get, before there was a waiting list on the OCU, so I was posted up to Kinloss, where I held on 120 Squadron, did a bit of flying there. As, you know, just an observer, and then posted down to St. Morgan on number 91 Nimrod course, did that, back up to Kinloss on 201 Squadron, and I spent 4 years on 201 Squadron, flying to before I then, by this time I was a master engineer, being promoted, and then I went to RAF Finningley as an instructor for 4 years, and then finally, the final job was an flight engineer on the VC-10 tanker, the K-2 and the K-3 tanker, at 101 Squadron at Bryce Norton. And I left the Air Force from there, just before the First Gulf War.
So I think we'll probably at some time come back to you and talk about the VC-10, because that probably has some interesting stories. But let's come back to the Nimrod.
Yeah, sure.
And in particular, the Maid Amore. Tell us about its history. It's up at the Yorkshire Air Museum, and it's a lovely piece of kit.
It is.
But where does it come from? What was its history, and why is it at Elvington?
Okay, fair enough. I'll give you a brief history of it. It was produced at Woodford. Its construction number was 8025. Its first flight as an MRM was on the 21st of January 1971, and it was delivered to RAF Kinloss on the 18th of February 1971. After that, it went to Malta and served on 203 Squadron at RAF Lucca until they disbanded on the 31st of December 1977.
Right.
It then came back to St. Morgan with 236 Operational Conversion Unit. And I first flew it at St. Morgan on the 27th of July, 1981.
Okay, that was going to be... that was going to be my next question, actually. Have you flown her?
And on that particular trip, the first trip, we did medium-level handling followed by circuit work. In other words, rollers or go-arounds now. Then 2 years after that, it was converted to the MR2 standard, and it returned.
Okay.
It returned to Kinloss on the 8th of July 83 to operate with the Kinloss Maritime Wing as a Mark II.
Right. Just coming back to though to the time on when you flew her and doing circuit work and go arounds. What would your role have been in that activity? Obviously, we all look at the pilots and what they're getting out of it. But as a flight engineer, what was your role in terms of those sorts of activities?
Well, sitting behind the pilots, there's a huge, great big panel with the hydraulics, the electrics, the pneumatics, the air conditioning, the pressurization, the auxiliary power unit. So in with circuit work, basically you're monitoring the engines and the systems. Normally I'd be looking forward, looking at the center instrument panel, because we've got the engine RPM and the turbine gas turbine temperatures. Now on my back panel, right. I've been looking at the electrics, make sure that was okay, and the hydraulics. Hydraulics power all the flying controls. So that's what I'd be doing, and monitoring the fuel usage and consumption. That would be my sort of job.
So is it fair to say you had to be relatively good at maths to do that?
Yeah, you did, because getting on to operational flying. You take off with 84,000 pounds of fuel, and I'd have a chart, and on that chart would be, I could project forward when our what would be called PLE, prudent limit of endurance, and that would be a line that would be at that particular point we had to have enough fuel left for a diversion if we couldn't get back into Kinloss.
Yeah,
and normally our normal diversion at Kinloss was Lossiemouth, believe it or not.
Okay, yeah.
Just down the road. But if that went out, then the next place would be St Morgan. So you'd need an extra, memory serves me right, 13,000 pounds of fuel. So you had to factor that into it as well.
Ken, were there not other diversion fields that were non, should we say, coastal command for the purposes of this exercise that you could have gone to, or was it particularly those airfields that had a particular reason for going there?
I mean, obviously with St Morgan, it had a Nimrod servicing base, but we would probably use Leeming or somewhere like that. Leeming, else would we use? One of the bigger bases like that we would use Lucas, probably. Could have got in at Lucas, no problem.
And what would a traditional sortie entail for you and the crew? What would be the duration? What would be the tasking? That sort of thing.
Duration, usually about 6 to 7 hours if it was a patrol. It would take off with full fuel load, and I'd have to manage that. As you're flying along, if we went to a search to the area, we would climb up to medium level altitude, cruise out to the area, say the North Atlantic, if we were tracking a submarine. And as we descended down, we'd close an engine down.
Okay.
And we'd fly on three engines until we burnt so much fuel off that we could fly on two engines. And of course, if you're doing that, you're reducing fuel, so you're extending your endurance. Yeah. So that line on the graph is moving to the right all the time.
Yeah. Hence my question about maths.
Yes. Well, not only that. If you're running on three engines, you've got one engine shut down on one side and you're running two on the other side, you're burning more fuel. So there were limits of how much those tanks across the wings could go out of balance. Yeah. So that's where a bit of the maths comes in. Because of the, that's it would be so much across the tanks. So once you got to that limit, then you'd have to sort it out. So that was the biggest thing I did during those long endurance flights. If we're on three engines, once you got it down to two engines, it was a little bit easier.
And the crewing on tasks like that, would it just have been one flight engineer, or
yes?
Say you'd go the full duration of
of the sortie. 6 to 7 hours on the maximum.
And any interesting sorties?
I suppose the one that would come to mind is we were tracking a Soviet that had come out of Murmansk at the top there. We sort of vaguely knew where it was going. But have you seen Hunt for Red October?
Yeah.
Have you watched that one? Yeah, it's very good. Yeah. Well, they come out of Murmansk and they track down the Iceland Faroes gap. So the Norwegians would track it, then the Americans would track it, then they'd hand it over to us at Kinloss. So if that came on, then I remember one we did. I got a week of the dog watch slot. You know, take off at midnight, land at 6 o'clock in the morning in the winter at Kinloss. I didn't see daylight for a week. But you went to bed in the dark. You got up, you flew in the dark, and you went back to bed in the dark and got up in the dark.
Yeah.
You know, short nights. But one particular trip, we were tracking this particular one, and I was tracking it by using my knee pad, and I knew the direction we were going is, let's say, southwest, and I was listening to the tactical intercom. To the navigators, putting this where they wanted the sonar buoys. And that's what we're doing, putting sonar buoys in a V shape as you go down the route, down the track. So you put them ahead. We got to one particular point and it all seemed to go pear shaped. They didn't know what, you know, all right, sit on your hands. What do you think's happening? Because they'd suddenly lost it. And I just piped up and I said, now for a moment, what engineer wants to speak? What do you want, Ed? I don't suppose by any chance you think he's doing a stern arc clearance to you. And it all went quiet.
What's that, Ken?
A stern arc clearance. If you watch Hunt for Red October, a submarine every now and again will do a circle and do a 360 turn and then resume back. Clearing his stern.
Yeah, understood.
That's exactly what he did. Within about 5-10 minutes, came back on track again. So that got my name as a tactical engineer. There you go.
One question about some of those sorties. And what was crew fatigue like for you? It's come out, we discussed it in an earlier chapter on the Shackleton, where they were doing very, very long duration sorties, and fatigue was a real issue because the Shackleton was not quite as comfortable as the Nimrod. But how was the Nimrod to be as a crew member on those very long flights?
That was okay, no problem at all. It had a nice toilet at the front. It was a fairly quiet atmosphere. It was a comfortable aeroplane. Even down low level, it could have been a bit more difficult. I mean, you've flown in some conditions where you've looked down at the sea and you're at 200 feet and the sea is white, absolutely white, and you've been thrown around and buffeted. Like, for instance, one of the first trips I did was on the... an oil rig in the North Sea had broken loose, called the Palmyra. Palmyra 58. If you look it up, it was a little bit of a disaster. That was after the Alexander Heland disaster, which Nimrod's from.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, it could be a bit tiring. And another one we did, we were looking for a light aircraft that had was being transited, being delivered from the States. You know, single pilot, seat piled in the back, extra fuel tanks, and he went missing over the North Sea. You know, we spent 5, 6, nearly 7 hours on that one. 50 minutes down below the clouds at 200 feet being thrown. 10 minutes above the cloud, comfort break, back down again. So, yeah, that was tiring. That was tiring.
What we have now is the standard startup of XV250 on one of its traditional thunder days at the Yorkshire Air Museum, and you'll hear Ken acting in his role as flight engineer. It's about 5 or 6 minutes long, so hope you enjoy this.
Can we have bomb doors selected to emergency?
Red bomb is on.
And selected emergency. Okay, ground flight deck, are we clear bomb doors? Mal, are we clear for bomb doors?
Clear bomb doors.
Okay, Commodore, please.
Commodore, select and shoot. Shoot, indicate.
Commodore, please.
Roger. Okay, this will be a standard start, 3, 4, 2, 1, after which we'll carry our flight control check, and I will run the engines up. So, everybody, any questions from anybody?
Negative.
Negative.
Okay. Ground, are we clear to start the APU?
I can confirm the door is open, you're clear to start the APU.
Okay, can we have strobes to red, please?
Strobes to red.
And you're clear to start APU.
Okay, starting the APU now. Button in. Held. And it's come out. TGT rising. Looks like a good start.
APU, good start outside.
Thank you. Just passing 500. APU stable, I think we're good for a start.
Copy, can I have services to number 3, please?
Okay, you've got fuel, air, CSD ground cooling, and services to number 3.
Mal, am I clear to start number 3?
Clear to start number 3.
Roger. Starting 3 this time. Button.
Ignition.
Evolve.
Ignition.
You have a location.
Steady green. HP cock ground start. RPM and TGT rising.
Oil pressure rising. Light out.
Lights in the front by 45.
And lights out at the back.
Number 3 HP cock, on unlocked. I have control of number 3.
Clear.
Mal, am I clear 7503, clear to start 4.
Shutting the APU down.
Clear 7503, clear 4.
Shutting the APU down.
Roger, copy APU shutting down, coming up on 3. Five on 3, can I have services to number 4, please?
You've got fuel, air, and CSD ground cooling on number 3.
Ground, start at number 4.
Clear.
Button. Air valve.
Ignition.
A rotation.
Ground rotation.
Steady green. Number 4 HP cut. Ground start.
Fuel flow.
RPM and TGT rising.
Oil pressure's rising. And the oil pressure lights out.
Lights out in the front by 45.
APU door closed.
All lights out at the back.
Number 4 HP cock. On or not. I have control of number 4. Mal, am I clear to start number 2?
Yes, clear to start number 2.
Can I have services to number 2, please?
Okay, you've got fuel, air supply, CSD ground cooling to number... Number two.
Roger,
starting
number 2 now. Button. Air valve.
Ignition.
Yeah, have
location. Steady green. Number 2 HP cock ground start.
And you have fuel flow.
RPM and TGT rising.
Oil pressure rising. Oil pressure light out.
I send the front by 45.
And lights out at the back.
Number 2 HP cot. On a lot. I have control of number 2. Ground, am I clear to start number 1?
Clear to start number 1.
Can I have services to number 1, please?
Here I've got fuel, air supply, and CSD ground cooling to number 1 engine.
Roger. Starting number 1. Air valve.
Ignition.
Yeah, have rotation.
Steady green. Number 1 HP cock, ground start.
Fuel flow.
RPM and TGT rising.
Oil pressure rising. Oil pressure light out.
Lights out by 45.
And all lights out at the back.
number 1 HP cock, on unlocked.
I'm bringing the generators online, number 3 generator first.
Roger.
Hydraulics, frequency, voltage checked, that's okay.
Okay, I have controller number 1. All engines are idle, engine start checklist complete. Call me when you're happy with the generators.
All generators online, voltage frequency normal.
A windmill turbine shut in the front. Okay, over to the Thunderdome running sequence.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
Given your knowledge, I wanted to explore some other aspects of the aircraft and talk to you about its role and you know, primary, secondary role, just from your perspective. Do you want to talk us through a little bit of that and bring in any experiences you may or may not have?
Okay. Well, main job was search and rescue. Search and rescue, then working with forces, and then later on in Afghanistan, the airplane was used as part of the tactical area.
Okay.
Search and rescue was mainly of course, hunting submarines. Yeah. That was the other one.
Should we kick off with the hunt the submarine bit, Ken? Because I'm really keen to understand a bit about the capabilities of the Nimrod, and I know you know probably a little bit more about weapons and that sort of thing. So what sort of armament was the Nimrods that you were flying, and particular XV-250, what would they carry?
Well, they would carry, weapons-wise, let me see, torpedoes, we carried those. We carried a lot of sonobuoys inside the aeroplane for tracking, passive tracking. But we also had active tracking sonobuoys called CAMS boys, okay. CAMBS, which was command activated multi beam sonobuoys.
Wow.
And they were the ones that, yeah, CAMS boys. They're the ones with passive ones. A passive one, you would drop it in the water, it would extend a hydrophone, in other words, a microphone, down to a certain depth and just listen for tracking. Now, one of the hardest ones to track was the Alpha class ones. And the only reason we're aware we could track them was on the 50 hertz signal that came out from the fridge on the submarine.
Okay. Wow. Wow.
That was an Alpha class one submarine.
Wow.
The rest of them, the diesel ones that were gradually went out, They were easier to track. You could recognise the signal, but the Alpha class ones, they're a bit more difficult. If you were prosecuting one in wartime, then you'd probably be using the CAMS buoys. And the worst thing a submariner wants to hear is a ping hitting his submarine, because it means there's something chasing him. Once you got that, you'd put a torpedo in the water, and that was quite an interesting way of doing it. The other things we had was a magnetic anomaly detector called MAD, MAD, and that's that big long thing sticking out the back of the Nimrod with this detector in it. And if we detect a large lump of metal in the water, i.e. submarine, so if you knew there was one in the area and you tried to prosecute it, you would fly along the track, and the guy operating it, one of the radar operators, would be looking for a huge, great big spike in the signal. It'd be trucking along, and all of a sudden you go, wow, right out to one side. And the first thing he'd shout would be MAD mark. And the next thing the pilots do would be haul it into a left-hand turn, into a rate one left-hand turn, and go screaming round the corner, back down parallel to the track, and then hopefully come back over the same point again, but a little bit further down. So you now got two MAD marks, and you go around again, and the next thing that would be happening would be bomb doors open, coming down, then downwind. On the next one, you drop a torpedo in the water and hopefully go chasing the submarine.
Right, okay. And
so that's one.
Sorry, Karen. No, I was just going to say some of the other weaponry that I know you had mentioned on some previous stuff, things like harpoons and sidewinders. Were they very much a later addition to the Nimrod's armoury?
Yes, they were. They were sort of coming in during the Falklands conflict. Certainly during the Falklands conflict, we did all sorts of bits and pieces. Yes, they were fitted with sidewinders, the ones that went down to the Falklands, harpoon as well. And that could take out a high-value target from a distance of about 84, 85 miles. And the way you would do that would be you'd be sort of skulking around in the weeds sort of thing. And then you'd come up top, put the radar on. Unfortunately, when you switch the search water radar on, people in the know, oh, blooming earth, there's a Nimrod in the area. That's the first thing they'd think. You do a surpic, which is a surface picture. You'd pick out the high-value target and dip down again. Hopefully nothing chasing you, then back up and then release a harpoon. And that would, from about 80 odd miles away, hopefully. I mean, during the Falklands War, it would be the Belgrano,
sure, you know,
the aircraft carrier. Which, anyway, the Navy got that one. But that would be the high value target.
Right, okay.
And the last thing we carried, have you been inside a Navy?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, when you look at the pilot's control column, there's two buttons on there. One says C and one says N. C is conventional, N is nuclear. And we used to carry NDBs, nuclear depth bombs.
Okay.
Which if you drop one of, you drop one of them, you'd spoil a submariner's whole day and kill a whole lot of fish.
Yeah, and one of them. Were you carrying those when you were on operations?
Okay. No.
Okay.
No,
okay.
We didn't. No, we didn't.
Did...
What we did do...
No, I was...
Sorry. What we
carry
did
on.
Do...
Sorry, my fault.
Yeah, what we did do was to keep the crews up to... speed. I think we got a day out once. We went over to Macrahanish, took the outline over there. The officers went off to do the work. That's the two pilots, two navigators, and the air electronics officer. We retired to the sergeant's mess where we had tea, coffee, biscuits, read the papers while they went off, and the armourers loaded two shapes into the aircraft and they went through all the checks. And then later in the day, once it had all been completed, we were about to kill us
again.
Right,
okay.
And that was a day out for us.
Talking of other days out then, were you involved in things like NATO exercises and training exercises with other forces in the Nimrod?
Yes, we did. Yes. We worked quite a lot on international exercises and also with our own Navy. For instance, if a ship had been working up, there was a submarine that had been working up, we would do an exercise with them, working either as the attacking forces or the defending forces. And they were quite interesting. They were quite interesting, working with them.
You mentioned the other role, and to be quite frank, I recognise the Nimrod very much in the search and rescue role. You know, those pictures of the Nimrods over either the oil rigs or over a vessel in distress and things like that. Do you want to talk us through that whole role that the Nimrod took up there? You know, very much the search commander, I think, is a term you've used.
Yes, that's right. We would act as scene of search commander by coordinating all aspects of the SNR operation, and using with both airborne and seaborne assets. If we brought it, you know, we'd provide top cover for helicopter by giving it navigational assistance and relaying instructions from the radio control centres. A typical example, in 1980, the Alexander Heland accommodation platform capsized in the Echo Fishfield in the North Sea, the loss of 123 guys. That Nimrod was on patrol for 7 hours and controlled the search in that particular area. Now, I've done it where we've done that sort of thing. Another one I did was, can you remember the Air India 747 that blew up over the southwest of Ireland? Well, I flew on that on the second day.
Right, okay.
I wasn't called out on SNR, but when that happened, the airplane that was on search and rescue standby, which we had one every day up at Kinloss, and then it would be transferred to St. Morgan. The three squadrons took it in rotation. We'd do a week each, so you were on 24 hours. Well, when that happened, the SNR aeroplane was flown out straight away to coordinate the operations there. And as it continued, of course, it would come back. Another one had been readied, so it would go out and take over from that. And I was on that one on the Air India one, it was a bit distressing to see, suitcases and bits and pieces floating on the sea. I didn't see any human bodies or anything.
No.
Do you remember the Fastnet race in 79?
I don't. I am old enough. I'm well old enough. I was a teenager, probably doing other things at the time. But as I say, when I looked at the TV, or when I think of looking back at the TV and seeing a Nimrod, I think of that search and rescue role. It's funny, seeing the Nimrod and thinking, thank God that's there. Yeah. Tell me about the Fastnet race then.
The Fastnet race, that was in August 79, when, in that horrible gale and everything, there's a lot of yachts really in trouble. Nimrod was scrambled from Kinloss at 4 o'clock in the morning. Now, he acted as scene of search commander until he was relieved by Nimrod from St. Morgan.
Okay.
They helped a Wessex get there with a positional fix, and they discovered a 50-mile error in the Wessex nav case. And they were trying to get the Wessex out. Yeah, yeah. Now, the captain, he says, when the Nimrod broke cloud cover over the sea at about 300 feet, sea state 8,
I don't even want to think about that, Ken. No, I just...
a 60-knot wind blowing.
Wow.
All the yachtsmen started letting off their, the red distress flags. Yep. In the words of the Nimrod skipper, it said, it was like a bloody fireworks display.
But I bet that was a sight for sore eyes to see the Nimrod appear.
The crew, worked like one-armed paper hangers to coordinate the immense rescue task. That's what they do. You float around. Now, this is where I mentioned before, this prudent limit of endurance. Yep. Okay. So you're cruising around, so you'd be conserving fuel to stay as long as possible until another one came out. And there was always another, there was always an SNR aeroplane on 15 minutes readiness.
Right.
At late at night.
I was going to say, Ken, when they came across in their search and rescue duties, when they came across vessels in distress, what kit did they have that they could drop for those poor souls on the surface?
Yeah. Okay, each aircraft would have carried an ASR kit, which is apparatus sea rescue, and it'd be one or two dinghies in the bomb bay. I mean, I'm attached in pairs or singly, and with two stores containers connected to it. And you would drop them to the people in distress. So there's all the stuff in the containers, plus to forget, to get into the life raft. So that would be that bit. A couple of things that happened. There was a Greek tanker called the Victory in 1982. It broke in half about 450 miles northwest of the Azores. Now, the Nimrod had a 1,000-mile transit to get there. The weather was it was atrocious. 65-foot waves and 80-knot winds.
So that's pretty much directly south of us, isn't it? Just flying south for 1,000 miles.
Yep.
Wow.
Well, they dropped the pair of dinghies in the water, and unfortunately, the tanker crew seemed unprepared for any disaster at sea and made no attempt to use the equipment dropped to them.
Okay.
They were eventually picked up by a helicopter.
Wow. And that begs a question then, Ken. Was a Nimrod scrambled to something like that? Because it could be the first one there. Because if the helicopter, eventually rescued them, was it the fact the Nimrod could get there, assess and act, rather than wait for the the rotary wing arrival? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. He would be there. First of all, and each of the air electronics officer, the AEO, had all the radios, and one of those was channel 16, which is the maritime frequency. So he'd be using channel 16 to talk to the vessel. Then the other radio operator would be talking to the helicopter on the way out, giving it help to that and assessing the situation like that. So seeing a search
command.
Right,
okay.
That was it.
And then finally, we saw obviously the Nimrod before the aircraft was withdrawn from service. Its role more as a surveillance platform and brought into that role, and before the MR4, obviously the end of that program. Was it in effect MR2s and MR3s that were then modified, or to carry additional equipment, or did they have anything extra, or were they literally taken from their sea-based tasking to fly overland?
The Mark III Nimrod was a bit of a a bit of a disaster, really, and that was eventually replaced by the AWACS, the Boeing E3.
Yeah.
I mean, that had a big bulge at the front and a big bulge at the back. And the problem was trying to get two radars sweeping 180 degrees, coordinated, sort of to give you 360 degrees, whereas the Boeing Sentry had the big one on the top and the big rotating dome on the top. So that was the Mark III. Now, the Mark IV, the MRA, it was Maritime Reconnaissance Attack, that's the MRA, and the Mark IV version. And they were the original Mark II frames that went to Woodford, and they were stripped and everything, new wings, fuel system. The engineer was replaced, no flight engineer on it. That was all like the Boeing 737s and the Airbuses, all the system. I mean, the guy who did that, what's his name? Was it John Nelson? That wasn't John Nelson. The guy, I knew him very well. He ended up as a squadron leader. He designed the flight engineer out of the flight deck. I can't remember his damn name.
Well, understandable. Understandable. Moving on. the airframe that the Nimrod was used in places like Afghanistan, and come in full circle, XV-250 is a tribute to those 14 servicemen who were lost in September 2006. But XV-250 herself, when did she finish service? And how has she ended up with you folks at Elvington?
Well, when that coalition government decided to get rid of them, six were earmarked for museums and places like that. They were, let me think, Manchester, Elvington, Coventry, Norwich, funnily enough, Manston, and there's another one.
Okay,
there were six.
That's okay. We're interested in 250.
250 arrived in April 2010. Flown in by Stuart Roxburgh, or Roxy as he was known, and the two flight engineers both went through training. Well, three of us went through training at the same time. That's Squad Leader John Innes and Master Ranger Kev Nurse. They were on the course after me. How did I get involved? The year before.
She's at Elvington now. She's preserved in running condition, isn't she? And she does runs in front of the public. Interestingly, alongside the Victor that you have there, so quite a sight. But tell us about the group that are working to keep her in that state. How are you folks doing it?
With difficulty, because obviously the airplane's now been on the ground for 14 years, and of course, you know, when you look inside, they're in good condition, but they certainly wouldn't fly again. But the guys looking after them are the two main guys I managed to meet when the airplane, just after the airplane had landed at Elving, both ex Nimrod guys, Mick and Mal. Good team. Mal's the paperwork expert, and Mick is now the team leader. I was initially, but I've sort of stepped back. They're the engine. They coordinate everything with the museum. So if fuel, for instance, the museum buys for us. And they look after it. We also have an electrician, a little guy called Fletch, who is worth his weight in gold, actually. He's very knowledgeable. Yep. His last job was working on buses in Bradford. Okay. We managed to recruit him.
Okay.
And he's the electrician side of it. We have Ben's. His name's Richard Hedges, but he's known as Ben's from Benson.
Of course.
For the
of course. Yeah. For those of you who can remember.
He's sort of he's Yes, right. He's sort of avionics. Yeah. I'm the flight engineer with another guy called Paul Matthews. He's another flight engineer, but a lot younger than me and has remembered more about the Nimrod, and I've forgotten more than I remembered. So
okay. I'm sure that's not true, but...
Oh, it is. It is. I kid you not. And then, funny enough, we've got two ladies on the team. No, three ladies on the team. Thinking
excellent.
About it.
Excellent.
Yeah, well, Mal's wife, Avril, she's on the team. And then Bence's wife, Fiona, she does the headset and long lead when we do the ground right. runs. The others do safety people. And then there's Hannah. Because her husband Phil was one of the original team, but he's now a ground engineer on the A400M at Bryce Norton as a sergeant. When I met him, he was an SAC technical guy at Coningsby, and I recruited him then to come and help us on the Nimrod. And he gradually went through; he got a corporal, then a sergeant, and he's now a ground engineer on the A400 Atlas at Bryce Norton. So
wow.
he's done well.
Wow!
So
and
that's really the team.
Relying totally on donations to keep everything going.
Well, it's the museum that supplies right. all the bits and pieces, but we do ask for donations inside the airplane. There's a can, please support the Nimrod, and if people like to put money in, then that's
yeah.
We've had some interesting characters come along and visit. Every comment is the same. They walk up the steps, they go in through the back door, and they go, "Oh, that smell."
Okay.
And anybody who's operated Nimrods or been on will know exactly what
right.
I mean. It's the smell of the aeroplane. And they'll go, "Oh, my goodness, it's just like being back home." And they do.
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
So just before we wrap up then, Ken, what's your abiding memory of the Nimrod? What do you think its legacy is for the UK?
Its legacy, oh crikey, a very good maritime patrol aeroplane, iconic. It was evolved from the
yeah.
Comet, which was the first sort of transatlantic, passenger jet aeroplane of its time, and it evolved from
yeah.
there. I think that'll be it.
And what about the most exciting thing for you about the Nimrod? Was there an exciting event? Was there an exciting point for you at all during all that time? First flight, maybe, or a sortie.
I think the first flight really. I'm afraid it doesn't really compare to my first flight in the VC-10 as a flight engineer.
Right.
I'm going to put that one in because I idolized the VC-10 and I worked on it and flew it. And when I got my tanker course, I did the 6 weeks ground school with, funny enough, people who knew me because I'd been a ground engineer and that was a flight engineer. So I did the 6 weeks, then did the simulator. And the first trip on the VC-10, we did circuit training and back and down again. And when we landed and shut down, and I just sat there, and Paul Wilcox, my screen, says, "Come on then." I just turned and says, "Can we go and do it again?"
Do you know what, Ken? That was when the UK made really, really good aeroplanes. Being a bit sentimental about our industry, we had some great aircraft, the Nimrod, the VC-10,
we did.
And many others. Yeah. Well, on that note, Ken, I'll put links to the team that you have on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter into the show notes for this episode. But thank you so much for your time. It's been a fascinating listen.
Okay, no problem at all. It's been a pleasure. It's sort of dragged stuff out of my memory that I've forgotten. But there you go.
Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.